Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program.
It's the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And it is mission accomplished for the Rosetta probe and for Philae. That's the European Space Agency erupting in cheers with the confirmation that Philae, the Rosetta probe lander, has made contact with the surface of a comet. It's an incredible feat. We're going to be talking more about that in just a few minutes. Plus, we're asking you why Americans don't vote. What does it take to get us freedom-loving people out to the polls to cast our ballots on Election Day? Have you ever regretted not going out to vote? No judgment. We just want to hear why. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. And the challenges for getting immigration reform passed as Congress heads back to Washington, D.C. today for a lame duck session. But first, it's taken 10 years, travel of 4 billion miles. But finally, the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft has placed a lander on a comet, and it's a mission that's never been attempted before. That lander is known as Philae. It's successfully landed on Comet 67P. That's Churyumov Gerasimenko for you enthusiasts out there. Here are the lead scientists speaking from the European Space Agency.
Okay, so we are there, and Philae is talking to us. First things he told us was that the harpoons have been fired, rewound, and the landing gear has been moved inside, so we are sitting on the surface. Philae is talking to us, more data to come and to be analyzed right now. The flywheel is going down, which it should do, of course. We are there, it's done its job. We are on the comet.
Philae will be able to take measurements and samples of the comet that scientists have never been able to get before. The research could answer key questions about the origin and evolution of our very own solar system, where the water on Earth came from, and maybe even clues about the origins of life here on Earth. Dr. Emily Rice is professor of astrophysics at the College of Staten Island and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History here in New York. Like so many of her colleagues, she's been watching today with bated breath. We spoke to her just hours before Philae made its landing.
For scientists, it's huge. Just the technological achievements alone, even if we don't get any data, just to show that we can go to a comet, that we can orbit around it, that we can put a lander on the surface. There's so many firsts in this mission that haven't been done before. Even if we don't get any more data, we still have phenomenal, very, very close-up pictures of a comet. And then there's 21 instruments on this spacecraft that have all been working. Even after 10 years in orbit, 2 years in hibernation, it's absolutely huge for all of those teams that put these instruments together, because hopefully this will provide technology developments for future missions doing even more amazing things.
Now, it was one thing to get Rosetta to the comet, obviously a long trip, and then a series of orbits, rotations, and some astronomical gymnastics to get it going just the same speed as this tumbling block of ice.
Mm-hmm. It passed by Mars once. It passed by Earth three times. It's been 10 years on the way. But putting a lander on a comet is even, you know, we've orbited things before. We've sent things out of the solar system. We've put things in orbit around Mercury, around Mars, around Saturn. But landing on an astronomical body is even trickier, and so that's going to be really exciting.
Can you explain a little bit about what it takes? I mean, it's one thing to imagine matching the flight of a baseball with another baseball and throwing it so that they travel just next to each other perfectly. I can imagine that. It's another thing to match it so perfectly that a flea could easily move from one baseball to the other mid-flight as though he was just walking downstairs.
That's a really great analogy for what this is. The speeds are absolutely enormous. The speeds are something like 15 kilometers per second, or over 30,000 miles per hour, that the comet and the spacecraft are moving at right now. But the differential speed between them is tiny. It's something less than a meter per second. And so this is really, the spacecraft is really at a leisurely pace relative to the comet.
Now, comets are not smooth surfaces by definition, almost. Everyone, if you haven't seen the pictures online, they're getting better and better every day,
yeah.
By the way, the high-definition pictures of the surface of the comet. Functionally, though, it's not a great place to try to touch down gently.
Nope. And unfortunately, you know, we couldn't choose the comet by its shape initially. We just had to choose it based on its location at first. So
they didn't even know the shape of this comet. Shape kind of like a big rubber duck.
Yeah.
And really irregular.
Yeah, it's very, very irregular. Some of the other comets that have been imaged, Lutetia, Comet Wild, are a little bit more round, a little bit more smooth. This one's what's called a contact binary. It might have even been two objects at one point that got stuck together. There's a very narrow neck between two larger bulges of the comet. And so that's, you know, that was kind of unexpected.
Now, the dynamics of the landing itself. Now, comet's not very big, what, about 2.5 miles, right, mm-hmm. in length.
You could just sit it on top of Manhattan.
Okay, so, right, which means in astronomical terms, it doesn't have a great deal of gravity. If you run a probe into that, it's really just going to bounce off. So how do you stick to something that doesn't have a whole great deal of gravity?
Yeah, it's a different problem depending on where you're going. Sometimes you want to try to not crash land on something. In this case, they want to make sure the lander sticks. And so there's a bunch of different methods to make sure the lander can actually stick and the instruments can then work into the surface. There are three legs on the lander that each have ice screws at the bottom. And so as soon as those make contact, the screws are going to go into the surface. But we don't even know really what the exact surface properties are, and so we don't know how well the ice screws are going to stick. There's also harpoons that are going to come down from the middle of the lander, and then there's a reverse thruster to give a little bit more push against the surface.
Taking samples of this big rotating ice ball from outer space, what can we really learn?
Oh, we're going to learn a huge amount. The instruments are going to take direct samples from the comet. That's never been done before. And so we're going to be able to directly get compositions, isotope ratios for things like water. The deuterium to hydrogen ratio is actually a big deal for the formation of solar systems and for where the water came from in the solar systems. Basically, how much heavy hydrogen is in the water. It's a very, very small amount, but how much there is sensitive to where the water formed.
Do we not know really where all of this water on this water planet that we live on came from?
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know where it came from.
We don't know where all of it came from.
It didn't form here, in other words.
Yeah. It didn't. I mean, Venus doesn't have this water. Mars doesn't have this water. They're very, very close.
So Rosetta is landing a probe on top of sort of the giant ball of raw ingredients from the solar system, not the processed food that we live on.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's very exciting. I hope you enjoy this day. I hope everybody who likes to follow interplanetary science and astrophysics really has a great time today.
It should be a great day. Thank you.
Dr. Emily Rice, professor of astrophysics at the College of Staten Island and researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. Bring it back down to Earth now, to the most populous country on Earth, where there's potentially a landmark agreement between the world's two largest carbon polluters. After 2 days of meetings in China, President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping have agreed to new targets to begin cutting carbon emissions, but not until 2030. Now, for its part, the United States says it will emit 26 to 28% less carbon. That's down from current targets of 17%. China has vowed to have 20% of its energy production come from clean sources by that time, even though it's going to continue to increase its carbon output for another 15 years under this agreement. It comes after closed-door talks that have been in the works for months between the two countries, according to government officials. With us now on the line is Jennifer Turner, director of the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hello.
Well, we went over the details of the potential agreement here. The United States is going to cut even more steeply, but China, which is still industrializing and has resisted calls to cut its carbon emissions, says we'll cut eventually, but we need to peak after 15 years. We're going to keep emitting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's this is very significant. I mean, it's a really U.S.-China very important climate relationship. But I should note that China has been taking a lot more action over the past decade to try to address their coal problem. And it's been accelerated in the last couple of years in great part because of that horrible air pollution you all have heard about, right? Coal is a big contributor to it. And so the Chinese government has seen that coal is really, it's too costly. I mean, it's a cheap fuel. It's readily available in China. But, you know, they're choking on their success.
Meanwhile, back in this country, well, let's stick with China because I'm going to come back to country. You're going to hear a lot of skepticism from me in just about a minute because
I cover
Washington, Jennifer Turner. So get ready.
I live here.
Good. So you know as well as I do. How about some skepticism about China? Agreeing on paper or in front of the cameras to massive carbon reductions is one thing. Delivering 15 years from now for an economy that is based on coal output is really another.
But if you look at where they've been investing, I mean, they've been the leading investor in clean energy technologies for the past 4 years. I mean, they're number one in installed wind. Last year, they put in 12 gigawatts of solar panels. They're going to do 14 this year, 14 next. I mean, they have been really ramping up the clean energy production. That said, their electricity consumption keeps doubling, right? Doubled between 2000, 2007, again today, and again by 2020. And so it's kind of a race, you know, trying to keep up that even though they're putting a lot of clean energy, they're still using a lot of electricity. But the fact is that they've been building up not only the hardware infrastructure, but starting to really, because of the air pollution problem, put rules in place that it's going to make pressure the coal sector to become even more efficient. And they also are installing, you know, they have installed the largest fleet of ultra supercritical coal-fired power plants. So the plants they're putting in are very efficient. But then, again, you come back to this heavy electricity production. The skies are still gray. They know that they need to do something because the public is increasingly unhappy in China about the quality of their air.
Yeah, Jennifer Turner, the skies are gray in the United States too, metaphorically, if not literally like they are in Beijing. And here's why. There is no consensus in this country about addressing climate change. We all know that. We've seen climate bills fail in Congress. We just came off an election where Republicans were elected to a massive majority with zero interest, not only in passing climate legislation, but pledging to rein in the EPA for what they're doing already. And my question is, does President Obama or the next president have any ability to really deliver on this agreement?
I think that, that's the ironic thing when we look at the two big energy superpowers, is that on the U.S. side, that we're seeing much less political willingness. And it does look grim on this side. That said, for many years, people in Congress and elsewhere have always pointed the finger, well, the Chinese aren't doing anything, right? Well, we are seeing that the Chinese are doing a lot. And it's not just because of, you know, government-to-government cooperation. We've got a really robust, you know, the U.S. NGOs, Natural Resources Defense Council, the Energy Foundation, lots of organizations have been building the capacity of the Chinese. So they're getting the kind of, again, policy, it's not always hardware tools, that they need to try to start to address this. I mean, the Chinese government sees that the pollution problem is to a degree that it really, it's threatening the economy and it's threatening their political stability. And so clearly it helps. If the U.S. and China come together, it helps China move their efforts in this direction even faster. But the Chinese, I mean, they really have shown they are shifting to try to become a much more low-carbon economy. It's a question of survival.
A question of environmental survival, but also somebody's political survival, possibly. That's Jennifer Turner, director of the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, a look at why people don't vote. And some of those reasons might surprise you. We've been asking you, have you ever regretted not going to the polls?
My name is Nicole, and I'm from Mansfield, Massachusetts. I actually blame employers for the low voter turnout because it's very difficult to get to the polls when you're at work for 12 hours a day and the polls are open for 12 hours a day. My husband didn't get to vote this year because he was at work for 12 hours and missed the voting time.
Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE to be part of this conversation. You can find us too on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Lawmakers are headed back into Washington today to convene 2014's lame duck session of Congress. Let me tell you something. It's a lot lamer than that comet duck that's orbiting out in space that we're going to land on. A big item on the agenda is immigration. Now, Congress is unlikely to pass a new law on immigration, but it's definitely on the White House's agenda. President Obama says he's going to enact a series of executive orders on immigration, despite warnings from Republicans saying don't do it. The president says it's just a matter of getting something done. Listen.
I prefer and still prefer to see it done through Congress, but every day that I wait, we're misallocating resources. We're deporting people that shouldn't be deported. We're not deporting folks that are dangerous and need to be deported.
Now, listen to Senator Mitch McConnell from Kentucky on the day after he was reelected to the Senate in an election that is going to make him the majority leader.
It's like waving a red flag in front of a bull to say, if you guys don't do what I want, I'm going to do it on my own. And the president's done that on Obamacare. He's done it on immigration and threatening to do it again. I hope he won't do that because I do think it poisons the well.
Now, House Speaker John Boehner said the president is playing with matches with this executive action on immigration, and that he could burn himself. His words. Al Cardenas was chairman of the American Conservative Union. He's also co-chair of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Immigration Task Force, and he joins me now. Al, as many as 5 million undocumented immigrants could be normalized by the president's executive action. He could sort of significantly dial this back or maybe dial it up a bit according to how much antagonism he wants to give the GOP here, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we've been at this since 2006, and the challenges and the problems have only worsened. And so it's important to have comprehensive immigration reform. The right formula, the right mix can only take place through Congress. You know, the president has announced he'll take certain executive action. I do know it's irritating to the leadership of the Republican Party, but frankly, you know, the Republican Party, now a majority in both chambers, has a responsibility to huddle and come up with a comprehensive bill that provides conservative solutions. And once that happens and they pass that bill, if the president signs it, it makes the executive orders moot. And so I wouldn't recommend to get distracted by all of this. I know there's an irritation factor, but those things should not get in the way of needed legislation in immigration or, frankly, anything else.
There's an irritation factor that's years in the making. One of the major Republican planks for the midterm elections was a lawless president who's acted on his own on immigration, who's acted on his own at the EPA. There's a lawsuit sponsored by the Speaker of the House on Obamacare. This kind of plays in to that plank and makes it very hard even for Republicans who would like to huddle, as you say, Al Cardenas, to do that.
Well, look, there's a genuine legal issue here as to how far does executive power go and what are the constitutional implications of the executive branch. And that's going to be debated in a courtroom somewhere, and that's fair enough. That's why we have a constitutional process to address those issues. But there's also a legislative responsibility, and there's not a dichotomy between proceeding as they will on a response to the legal question of constitutional authority, while at the same time, frankly, the legislature exercising its own responsibility. And they ought to do that. They ought to do it sooner rather than later. And frankly, the windows of opportunity are not significant, because once we get past the summer break of 2015, we'll have the presidential elections in full display. Yeah. And it becomes more difficult to pass meaningful legislation.
Even more political than we already are now, if that's possible to believe. And Al Cardenas says, as you know, comprehensive immigration reform has banged around Congress for the last couple of years. The Senate passed a bill with 67 votes, people from both parties, but it's been the House that hasn't been able to get a bill up. You know, I was in a briefing with the Speaker, with Speaker John Boehner just the other day, and he was asked, if the president backs off, will you have a vote on immigration reform? He wouldn't guarantee, he wouldn't even make that promise to have that vote. So we're kind of at a moment of impasse, it seems.
Well, the Speaker on a number of occasions has expressed his commitment to pass immigration reform, and he's been waiting for the right window to do that, given the nuances of his caucus. We came pretty close towards the end of the primary season this year, and we had, you know, there were a couple of bumps on the road politically, and members backed away. But that same group of members who were willing to accept some drafts of a comprehensive measure should rehuddle and should be willing to proceed at the beginning of the, you know, of the 114th session starting January 5th. Look, there's a narrow window of opportunity, should be one of the top two or three priorities of both chambers. And I know that the American people will be deeply disappointed, because one thing is the intramurals in the House itself, and also the tension with the White House. But the overwhelming mandate of the American people in this election cycle was that they wanted a government that were problem solvers. The American people understand that this is a huge issue that remains to be solved. And we're going to be judged accordingly whether we move forward or not. And frankly, you know, in the last 10 years, we've had four changes with a majority. The American people has both parties on a short leash.
Yep.
And my sense is, if meaningful things don't take place, and if meaningful issues are not addressed, the American people will once again make a change. And that's not good for the current leadership.
And we'll see if the election has provided enough incentives for members of Congress to try to supersede the president on an issue that lots of voters are thinking about, immigration. Al Cardenas, former chairman of the American Conservative Union. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
From the mass movement of refugees away from the brutal civil war in Syria to the arrival of tens of thousands of Central American children on the U.S. border earlier this summer, the global community is facing an unprecedented migrant crisis. Just in the last few weeks, 500 refugees fleeing Egypt died when their boat was sunk by traffickers. And a few weeks later, a boat off the north coast of Turkey sunk, killing at least 24 people. And just this last weekend, more than 250 migrants from Myanmar were found at sea attempting to make their way to Thailand. That country plans to send them right back home. Ambassador William Swing is the Director General of the International Organization for Migration, and he says migrants can be protected from disaster if the international community is willing to take the problem on.
We live in an era of unprecedented human mobility with more people on the move than ever before. About one in every seven persons on our 7 billion globe are migrants, either internationally or nationally, within their own countries. Unfortunately, it's also a period of unmitigated and unprecedented disasters. We have four top-level crises in Syria, Iraq, South Sudan, and Central African Republic. And we have now the Ebola problem in West Africa. So we're facing this, and this is one of the many drivers of migration, forced migration. This is a trend, a mega trend of our century that's going to continue at least until mid-century.
So we hear a lot about the disasters that you're mentioning, certainly Gaza, the civil war in Syria, also ISIS in Iraq and Syria, the Central African Republic, and Ebola. But we think a lot less about really the ancillary issue, or what's seen as the ancillary issue, the aftermath. Forced migration under some horrific circumstances. There's an example just 2 months ago that we have to talk about where a boat carrying refugees from Egypt to Malta was rammed and sunk by traffickers. 500 people died.
It was very much a criminal act, and we have condemned it as such. There are many gangs, criminal gangs of smugglers. People are paying $1,000 to $4,000 to get on one of these rickety boats, many of which, like this unfortunate incident, don't make it. The number one priority has to be to save life. If life is not saved, there are no options. I don't know if you've seen our documentation, but we came out with a publication called Fatal Journeys. And we documented 40,000 migrant lives lost since the year 2000, 22,000 in the Mediterranean, making Europe the single most dangerous destination for illegal or irregular migrants. And I think those figures are grossly underestimated. It's probably much more. But interestingly, governments don't keep statistics on migrants who lose their lives. They keep statistics on those who cross the borders and those who are sent home.
Well, let's zero back in then on the situation here at home in our own country in the United States. Ambassador William Swing, I think you know as well as I do that in the current political climate, it's almost impossible to imagine a policy that actively tries to make it safer, less deadly, less fatal for migrants who are trying to reach the border of the United States so that they can emigrate.
I think what we're talking about here, frankly, is the third of the unprecedented mobility, unprecedented disasters. There's also unprecedented anti-migrant sentiment in much of the industrialized world. And our great challenge in the period ahead is going to be, how do we change the migration narrative in a manner that it comes back to recognize the historically, overwhelmingly positive contribution that migrants have made? Our own country was built on the backs of migrants, will continue to be enriched by migrants. But until we can change that narrative, unfortunate laws will be put in place that criminalize those who arrive without proper papers, put them in detention centers rather than centers where they can be processed according to their category. So there's a lot of work to be done there.
Ambassador William Swing is Director General of the International Organization for Migration. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. You know, we've called it dismal, we've called it abysmal, pathetic, even disgraceful. Yeah, I'm talking about voter turnout last week. Just 36.4% of eligible voters turned out in the midterms. And as you've probably heard over the last couple of days, the lowest number, the lowest percentage since 1942 in the middle of World War II. So why did so few people show up? Apathy? Sure. Disgust with Washington? Probably. All the negative ads? Yeah, all that too. But we want to talk a little bit about what we can do to improve it. Can't get all those ads off of TV, but we can probably do a lot to make voting easier, more convenient, even some reminders. Well, Seth Flaxman is co-founder and executive director for the nonprofit Democracy Works organization. They have a website called turbovote.org. They're trying to demystify the often antiquated and sometimes bureaucratic loopholes that people have to go through in order to vote in this country. Hi, Seth.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin at the beginning. You know, when people talk about the inconvenience of voting, and we're also going to talk about apathy, because I got to put you on the spot about this. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that a website that makes it easy to vote takes care of the fact that people are disgusted with Washington. But let's start with ease, if we can. Why do we vote on Tuesday? That's always the first question. And I've covered politics for years. I don't get why it's not on Saturday when everybody's off.
Right. So this is actually a great story. It's a metaphor with a lot of the problems in the system. So we vote on a Tuesday because that was the height of convenience for voters in the 1700s. Sunday was church day. Then if you were in George Washington's district, you'd go down, travel to his house Monday, get drunk at a party. Then Tuesday morning, the two candidates would line up in the square. And you would, one at a time, shake the hands of the candidate you supported in front of everyone, and you'd be back home in time for market day on Wednesday. So we have a long tradition in the U.S. of making voting fit the way we live. The problem is that it's fitting the way we lived in the 1700s.
So this is a relic of our past, and of course we have a lot more people. We work much different work hours now, So tell me how turbovote.org works. I live in Washington, D.C. I don't get to vote for a senator, so that might make your job easier. But the election's coming up. What's my experience like on your site? What do you do for me?
Yeah, so the idea is someone should be able to sign up once and then get help with everything they need to stay registered and vote in all of their elections for the rest of their life. That's what we're trying to achieve. So what that means is if you need to register to vote, if you need to vote by mail, there are our forms often involved in that, so we'll fill out those forms for you. We'll email them to you, but we can also mail them to you with a pre-addressed, pre-stamped envelope. We used to say that was easy as Netflix, back when Netflix was mostly mailing you DVDs. And then we'll send text message and email reminders to make sure that you meet all of your deadlines. So a reminder to send in your vote by mail application and then the ballot. And if you're voting in person, you know, reminder like tomorrow's your primary election, here's where your polling place is. So anywhere where there's a piece of friction we can take out of the process with information, that's what we try to do.
You try to smooth out the speed bumps, and there are many for people to get their vote in.
Right, exactly. And this is a major point and something you alluded to when we started talking. When you look at the census data, the census actually asks people why they don't vote. And in 2012, the majority of people who didn't vote, nearly 60%, attributed to just a range of process issues. You know, everything you can imagine, sort of like registration process issues, inconvenient polling place, had to work, weather, transportation problems. And this is the low-hanging fruit of the problem. We can do a lot to address those problems without needing to make legislative changes. We just need to work on the technology and often with the local election administrators who actually run the elections, where people really aren't building good innovative technology for them.
Well, that's fair enough, Seth Flaxman, but let me read you a comment that we got from Lyndon, who wrote to us on Facebook. The politicians spend millions to say what or who they hate and are against, but don't offer the voters anything that they plan to do other than to dismantle what has been done by their enemy rival. This is somebody who says that they vote even though it seems pointless. Now, convenience is great. Smoothing out those speed bumps is fantastic, but you can't do anything really about disgust with Washington, with apathy, with people being turned off by gridlock and by a system that they feel has nothing to offer them, I suppose, unless you think that a generation of voters will change that dynamic. But that's a long way off.
Well, I mean, there's two different thoughts on that. The first is that, you know, the politicians ultimately only are going to represent the people who vote. And when only 30 to 40% of people are voting, those are the people that politicians are really going to worry about serving. So if we can increase participation by those 50% of people for whom process is the main part of the issue, we'll already have changed the game significantly. And then we can really address some of the apathy and disengagement issues. But I think the ordering of tackling these problems is important, because if you do find a way that you can engage someone who's really disengaged from the process, but then they have this awful voting experience, they're not going to be turned into a lifelong voter. They're going to realize, like, oh, this one time I thought it was worth it, and then I just had this awful voting experience. So I think you have to make the experience better so that when you do get someone interested in voting, you can help them turn them into a civic behavior, a habit over their lifetime.
Now that voting and ease of voting has become a political issue, let's face it, there are lots of Republican state legislatures that are erecting barriers to vote. They say it's for voter fraud. Their opponents say it's to keep Democratic voters away from the polls. Now that voting and the ease of voting is a partisan issue, do you find yourself trying to get people out to vote playing to one side? There is a party in power in Congress, at least after January, that in some states has been trying to keep people away from the polls. You could be construed at this point as participating in partisan activity.
Right. So it's unfortunate. We've worked to gain a lot of Republican support for our work, and we've been successful. So I think some of this is actually a myth. But where we really have to work is the local level with local election officials. In the U.S., our elections are run at the county level and in seven states at the town level. And what we find is that most of the public servants, a Republican or Democrat working at that level of government, really are true public servants who are trying to deliver a good voting experience with very limited means. And when we talk to them about trying to serve their voters better with better technology, all we get is excitement regardless of party. And, you know, maybe we're just blessed that we get to work at the local level and not the national level, but that's what we're seeing.
Can I make a suggestion, Seth Flaxman? We're going to let you go, but just can I make one?
Of course.
Sort of vote. How about every text message, Facebook message, email that you send out, just a little note saying, by the way, turn off the TV. The fewer those ads you see, the more likely you might be to vote. Just turn it off.
Great idea. Thank you.
Take me up on it.
I think it might help. Absolutely. I'm going to do it.
That's Seth Flaxman. He's co-founder and executive editor of the nonprofit Democracy Works. They have a website called turbovote.org. Trying to turn them out. Seth, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, what about you? Feeling apathetic? We asked you if you've ever regretted not going to the polls, and we got a lot of calls from people who say, oh, no excuses.
This is Pat calling from Dallas, Texas. Regarding voting, I have never not made it. Grew up in a family where you voted, period. Busy? Vote early.
Hi, my name is Anna. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Question was, have I ever missed voting? And if so, what did I feel about that? And my answer to that is no, because voting is an absolute responsibility of every single citizen. And if you don't vote, you have no right to complain or whine or mince any words because you don't like what's going on. It's your requirement as a citizen to do your job and vote.
Well, PolitiFact says that with a 14% approval rating, still more than 95% of incumbents were reelected last week. A wave? No. We sent them all back. Give us your take at 8778 MyTake. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.